Happy Saturday. It's March 9th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
As always, Michael, many highs and lows in the news this week. It's officially been the rainiest February on record here in London. That's depressing. Moscow, as we know, is making serious gains in the east of Ukraine. Even bicycle deaths in New York are at a 23-year high. I blame cell phones for that one. But we have a fantastic episode of Morning Meeting full of promising news, including some interesting talk about an unlikely but potential new American hero.
Yeah, while Donald Trump continues to move towards the Republican nomination, it now appears that of the four criminal indictments he's facing, the only one that's likely to go to trial before the election is one known as the Stormy Daniels case. And Jeffrey Toobin spoke with Daniels and will tell us how her testimony could convict him and possibly preserve democracy in America. Then Alexander Marshall will join us from Paris. Yes, the rest of the world, Ashley, is dreaming of seeing the Olympics sparkle in the City of Light when the games open on July 26th, but as Alex reports, the games and the construction and chaos they have created have left the city and its always curmudgeon-y residents on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Then, John Maucheri has a fascinating and largely forgotten true story, how an all-black production of Hello, Dolly! Starring Pearl Bailey became a smash hit on Broadway in 1967 and helped change American culture. Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Well, let's get Jeffrey Toobin on here. I mean, this guy, making the rest of us look bad again. I mean, he's an incredible legal mind. He's also a skilled storyteller, and he brings us right inside this David and Goliath fight between Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels in a way that is frankly riveting. I'm so happy to have him here. Jeffrey Toobin is a legal analyst and a journalist. He's the author of many books, probably more than I've read total in my life. Most recently, his work is Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh, and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hi, team.
So, Jeffrey, we haven't heard all that much from Stormy Daniels in the last few years. She was, I don't want to say a national joke, but there were some elements of her story that became parodied in the press, et cetera, et cetera. Your story this week reveals how incredibly important she is to the future of American democracy. So what have we missed?
Well, it's just an amazing series of events, like so much connected with Donald Trump. He was indicted in four separate cases over the past year or so. For a variety of reasons, his lawyers, it appears, have succeeded in pushing off three of them until after the election, and they may never be held at all, especially if Trump wins. But the one that will go to trial is the one that is based on the $130,000 he paid to Stormy Daniels on the eve of the 2016 election to keep her quiet about the tryst they supposedly had in 2006. And she is going to be a key witness. What I found out is something that had been hiding in plain sight for a number of years now, is that Stormy owes Donald Trump more than $500,000. I had no idea that was the case. And when you tell people that, they sort of can't believe it. Like, why would Stormy Daniels owe Donald Trump all this money? And that's really what my story in Airmail this week is about, is the story of that debt and its implications for the one and only case that Donald Trump is going to face before November.
So how exactly, Jeffrey, did she end up $500,000 in the hole to Donald Trump?
Well, this also relates to one of the semi-forgotten characters in the Trump drama, who is Michael Avenatti, who was her lawyer and a major figure in cable news, at least in 2018. Avenatti filed a lawsuit on her behalf against Donald Trump. She says without his permission, without her permission, I can't really determine that at this late date, but he did file this lawsuit. It was a defamation case, and it was a weak case, clearly. And what the judge did was not only dismiss the case, but assess Trump's attorney's fees against Stormy. Stormy had to pay because this was essentially a frivolous case. Initially, that was almost $400,000. After an unsuccessful appeal by Stormy, it's over $500,000 that she owes him. And this has been plaguing her and hanging over her for all these years. And now Trump is moving to collect. Stormy doesn't have $500,000 to give Donald Trump, doesn't want to give Donald Trump $500,000, and doesn't think she has to. But the legal system has created this debt for her. She has no real way of dealing with it. And she, at the moment, and this is sort of what my story is about, has kind of thrown up her hands. Her lawyer fired her. She doesn't really have a plan for dealing with it. As a key witness against Trump in this case that's going to trial on March 25th, she is going to be confronted on cross-examination with this debt. Like, isn't it a fact that you owe Donald Trump $500,000? Isn't that the real reason you are lying to get him convicted because you're so angry about it? That's the gist of at least part of the cross-examination, and it's going to be a real problem for the prosecution.
It sounds like such a small sum of money compared to all the money that Trump owes, but do you think that part of the reason he's going after this $500,000 is because he's in debt, $80 million to E. Jean Carroll, et cetera?
No, I really don't. I think it's more just generally harassment. He started moving to collect before both of those debts were incurred. I think he recognizes that while $500,000 may be a small sum in his world, it means a great deal to a semi-retired porn star who does not have vast sums of money. She really doesn't have a way to raise $500,000. So I think this is meant more generally to just afflict Stormy and disrupt her life than it is to make a meaningful dent on his debt, which surely wouldn't. And she doesn't have it anyway, as he probably knows.
Jeffrey, you spoke to Avenatti, you spoke with Stormy, some great insights in speaking with them. Stormy, you said, it's like, let him come arrest me, basically, right? I mean, she's got no play, but that could be her best play, right?
I don't know. I mean, one of the great things about Stormy is that she is really unfiltered and she says things that pop into her head, but there's also a kind of wisdom to it. And she says, what good have lawyers ever done me? Stormy hired Michael Avenatti. Avenatti got her into this disastrous debt situation, wound up stealing money from her, which is one of the reasons he's in prison. This new lawyer she got hasn't done anything good for her. Like, what have these lawyers ever done for her that's been successful? That doesn't mean that her current kind of existential journey into the void is the right strategy, but you can sort of see why she thinks that way. And the thing, it's interesting that the thing that she really fixates on when you talk to her is Trump's lawyers sent her forms to fill out, including the name, address, and financial arrangements of her 13-year-old daughter. And she just says, look, I am never telling Donald Trump anything about my daughter. That is an absolute bright line. And that's one you can pretty well understand. But it's just not clear to me where things go from here, except that if and when she testifies at the trial, which starts here in Manhattan on March 25th, she's going to be a problematic witness for the prosecution, in at least in part because of this debt.
Jeffrey, I must confess, I did not read her autobiography. What was it called?
Well, I guess you're not a very well-read person.
I read Matthew Perry's.
It's called Full Disclosure. I read it so you didn't have to, Ashley. So yes, I have read it, even though you have.
Well, she has kind of a fascinating story. I mean, she came from a troubled background, as you report, but she got straight A's. She was abused by a neighbor. I mean, she's kind of a remarkable woman in many ways and became a powerhouse in the porn industry, no?
Absolutely. No, I think she is a genuinely interesting and complicated person and no dummy. That is for sure. As you say, she's 44 now. She was born in Bismarck, North Dakota, raised in Baton Rouge, came from a really horrendous background. Her parents split when she was very young. Her mother kind of fell apart, couldn't keep house. The house was filled with rodents and rodent poop. From ages 9 to 11, she was sexually assaulted by a neighbor who was in his 40s. At 17, sort of on a lark, she started stripping and turned out to be good at it, made some money, and went into the porn industry. But unlike so many people in the porn industry, she did not destroy her life with drugs and booze and her intelligence, which, as you mentioned, she was a top student in high school, editor of the school paper. She's become both a director and a writer in the porn industry. She has had some bit parts in mainstream movies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And she has been a real entrepreneur in her life, notwithstanding the fact that she is a porn actress and people may make judgments about that. And the funny thing about Stormy is she kind of has a sense of humor about the craziness of her life. I mean, she proudly got breast enhancements at a very young age, and she has nicknamed her breasts Thunder and Lightning. I mean, it's hard not to get a kick out of some of the things she does. And some people can just write her off because she's a porn actress. I assure you, this woman really sort of knows what's going on in the world.
Jeffrey, basically, when it comes to Donald Trump, do not make predictions. But if you were looking at this trial, I guess, number one, what would you say something to watch for? Number two is, how do you think it could play out?
Well, the important thing about this trial is to think about the charges. Because the charges are based on the $130,000 that Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer and former friend, paid to Stormy on the eve of the 2016 election to keep her quiet about this 2006 tryst. But that's not a crime. That's important to remember. It's not a crime to pay someone hush money. The crime here is that in subsequent years, as Trump paid Michael Cohen, who fronted the money, covered his debt, he misreported the money on his taxes and on his corporate records. He said it was a legal fee when in fact it was money that just went to Stormy. And the way the Manhattan District Attorney is trying to play this case is as an election interference case, saying, look, what matters here is not the hush money. What matters here is Donald Trump was trying to deceive the voters in 2016. He was trying to use his corporate money to deceive the voters about his background in connection with this woman. And what I think is going to be interesting to watch as the trial unfolds, which is starting this month, is the public, and most importantly, is the jury going to see this case as sort of a sex romp about this middle-aged man who may or may not have had a tryst with a porn star? Or will they see it as a serious effort to interfere with the election? And that's going to be a struggle here. The problem the prosecution has is sort of getting everyone to take this seriously. The problem the defense has is it's pretty clear what happened here. I mean, the money did go from Cohen to Stormy, and then Trump paid Cohen. I mean, the checks exist. So I don't know exactly what the defense is going to be here, except that this whole case is bullshit and no one should pay any attention. That's generally not a great defense, although, as you point out, it's very unwise to make predictions where Trump is concerned. The other point simply to make is a hung jury is a win for Trump. The only way the prosecution wins is to win. And hung juries can happen with one person, and jury selection is going to be an unbelievable challenge for both sides. Stay tuned.
Jeffrey, thank you so much. Great story, and always love speaking with you.
Thanks, team.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Bye, Jeffrey. It's so fascinating to me how, despite all of Trump's attempts to knock down women, he's managed to create an American hero in E. Jean Carroll and also potentially now another American hero in the form of Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, he can sort of take on all these other elements, but the women keep coming back to him, keep asserting themselves against him, I should say.
It's fascinating stuff.
Well, speaking of fascinating, you know what's pretty amazing to me is what's happening in Paris right now.
Right, Michael. They have good news on the horizon, the arrival of the Olympics at the end of July. But of course, it's been plagued with scandal, and Alexandra Marshall, a writer at large for Airmail who is based in Le Perche, France, is here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're great. We love your story this week because, of course, who has bad things to say about the Olympics? But in Paris, we are at a moment where the clock is ticking, Alex. And it seems like whenever the Olympics happen, there's always drama and reported stories in the press about, oh, nothing is going to be finished on time. And there's all this controversy surrounding various elements. But in Paris, it seems to be more heightened than normal. So what's exactly going on in your fair country?
Well, first of all, don't ever count out the Parisians as the world's greatest complainers and the world's most alluring drama queens. So to a certain extent, when people complain and make noise, it's just kind of like a sexier attraction. But honestly, Parisian residents are freaking out. The Olympics were voted on in 2017. So Paris got the news in 2017. It had already been undergoing a massive urban renewal plan called Le Grand Paris, whose aim was to greater integrate the suburbs with the city center and to extend public transportation, which entailed massive work for like years and years. So Parisians, even before the Olympics were approved, were already fed up. Also, the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, has a lot of green ambitions for the city, which are great, but which have entailed also like a really radical amount of roadworks, denying access, canceling roads so cars are accessible to far less of the city, opening massive amounts of bike lanes, things that are big picture great, but which have been incredibly annoying for Parisians to put up with. So the context of the arrival of the Olympics is to a city that is has already had it. Combine that with a lot of rosy forecasts of like, hey, it's going to be great. We're going to cut the carbon footprint in half, which they may actually succeed at. It's going to be such an amazing marketing opportunity for France, which is true. LVMH has signed on as one of the partners of the game. So there's promise that is exciting and that French people can get excited about in the big picture. Parisians, not so much though, because they've just been living with the drama. And once the games actually start at the end of July, the city is going to go on a kind of lockdown that residents are really worried about. There's going to be less public transport flowing. The prices are going to go up during the games. Prices to museums are going up during the games. Hotel rooms are getting really expensive. Airbnbs. And French people, Parisian residents are standing around kind of just going like, this city is difficult enough to navigate as it is. Traffic is already so horrible. So they're just all kind of freaking out in advance. The context is not mellow, shall we say.
Alex, as you report, there are 38 Olympic venues around the city. So this is really wreaking havoc everywhere. But the Seine, the river in the center of Paris, is really the center of things. And that's the venue for the opening ceremonies, or at least the proposed opening ceremonies. The one thing we can all agree on is that we might not be watching the diving competition, but we are going to watch the opening ceremonies. And there's an elaborate plan to host those in the center of the Seine. What should we expect?
Really good question. Okay, the Seine has two issues, as you mentioned. We have the opening ceremonies, and then we also have competitions, like swim competitions, that are supposed to take place in the Seine. The opening ceremonies, the big challenge is security. Can you imagine, like in the center of Paris, in residential neighborhoods with buildings all along the riverside, and they're going to have to shut down traffic and they're going to have to put up stands. And I mean, they said they wanted 600,000 people to come. Now they've halved that number and they may end up having to reduce it again because we are, as you may have noticed, living in a context of global insecurity and violence. And so terrorism is always a worry. And why wouldn't it be now that we have two hot wars in countries where France has strong relations? So the Seine is a security risk for the opening ceremonies, even though we have just learned the athletes will be all wearing Dior. So, of course, we all want to check them out, the French ones at least. So that's that. Also, then the swimming in the Seine is another challenge because the water has to be clean. And for the last maybe 30 years, they've been trying to make the Seine accessible to swimmers. It started when Jacques Chirac was the mayor. Nobody has pulled it off. And they, according to the latest public reported on by the press, not official stats offered by the government, but information, the water is not clean enough. There's E. coli. They've found molecular compounds associated with rat urine. There's hepatitis A. So like, elite athletes from the world over jumping in to take a swim is still a dicey proposition. And the pollution tends to get worse whenever there's been a big rain because there's a lot of runoff that goes into the water. So among the many works happening in Paris, there are runoff basins that are also being constructed to try to keep this to a minimum. You get the feeling that they are kind of improvising or making it up as they go along. It's unfair to say that, but there was just a very recent report about how there's all these residential buildings along the Seine. So people would naturally want to stand on their balcony and watch the opening ceremonies from their homes if they can. But oops, we haven't done safety checks on those balconies in like a really long time. Even though landlords are all supposed to volunteer to be in compliance with safety norms, they never enforce that. Well, now suddenly the city goes, oh, wait, we might have to clamp down on that. So can you imagine residents who are living in the center of the city who have already or seeing their movement radically constrained, the one nice thing they might have is a chance to have some friends over and watch the opening ceremony from their balcony. And now it's going to be like three people minimum to a space of 35 square meters. It's just not cute from their residential point of view.
Alex, I have an important question. As you note at the beginning, there's no more attractive drama queen than a Parisian. We all love Paris. I love Paris more than anyone, or as much as anyone. But I'm just noting all this sort of drama that they're forecasting for Parisians. The games open, I just want to note, July 26th, which is essentially August 1st. Where do Parisians go in August? They're never in Paris. I've been in Paris in August. They're not there. None of these people are going to be there.
Well, not everyone can get out. I mean, the people I spoke to, the story not. And some even are like interested in going to the games. But yes, it's true. Paris deserts itself. But normally what replaces Paris, those Parisians are just the normal summer hordes of tourists, which are already a big deal. But now add to that. And the games the French media has been reporting that a large amount of the forecasted visitors to the games are going to be actually French people who are just coming in from the province. So it's going to be a different wave of people coming and going than the usuals. And there will be more people coming in total than the average sort of summer tourism visitor forecast. So the Parisians themselves who can leave are leaving, absolutely, but not all of them can, and they're freaked out.
Alex, the woman at the center of all of this is Anne Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, and she's an ambitious politician. But as you write in her story, she isn't really acting that way at the moment. How has the relationship between Anne and her constituents evolved over the course of this Olympics debacle?
Been terrible. I mean, again, as we mentioned before, Parisians have been fed up with the constant roadworks and the drama and the traffic for a long time already. Then we had COVID, which was kind of actually, for some Parisians, a break in all the drama. Just with nobody in Paris, you could walk around and breathe fresh air most of the time. But Anne Hidalgo and the Olympics, what's funny is that when she ran for mayor in 2014, she was against the Olympics. She was actually anti-Olympics. She said they're expensive and they're an environmental disaster and they reproduce inequality and all the great things that a socialist mayor is supposed to say. And then the socialist president at the time, François Hollande, of course, really, really wanted the games. And so Anne, being a good member of her party, kind of shut it down a little bit and then became pro-Olympics. So she's since become very pro-Olympic games, except that the cracks are starting to show. She's the one who is going to take a lot of blame if things go wrong. So to a certain extent, it's fair enough for her to be apprehensive. But she is, one wonders if she's not starting to sabotage her fellow stakeholders in the games. She's been talking about how the transport system isn't going to be ready, which sets everyone's hair on fire. She's not getting along with the head of the Olympics committee. She's not getting along with Macron's minister of sport. She's kind of bit of a sourpuss around all of this. And you almost wonder if she is staking out a position of like, I told you guys all this was going to be terrible. It's hard to say. It all depends on how the games go. And Ashley, what do you and Michael, what do we three know more in Paris than a fashion show? And how many times have those shows been 3 o'clock in the morning the night before, getting set up, last minute scotch tape, and suddenly it's all incredible? So they could end up pulling it off and then she'll bask in the glory. But you sense that she's like staking out a position of, if it all goes bad, I told you so, or something like that.
That doesn't seem very French to me. That's not a French.
To be pessimistic in the worst of your sense.
Impossible, no.
Never.
Disaster, no.
Well, but what's weird, though, is that, again, we don't know whether she's running for mayor again or not. So that's another open issue.
To your question, I mean, come on. It's Paris. It's the Olympics. I would predict also, like, on TV, it's going to look amazing. And you're right. Like, no one knows how to put together a spectacle like the Parisians. Maybe you don't want mimes on the opening ceremonies. But other than that, it's the most photogenic city in the world.
Exactly. You know, and the idea of doing the opening ceremonies down the Seine on that stretch was between the two of the really central bridges, so you'll have absolutely stunning, glittering views. It's like you can totally understand why everybody is pushing to make it happen. At the same time, very publicly, all of the organizers involved have said there is no plan B for the opening ceremonies.
Well, Alex, if there's one thing we're looking forward to, it's speaking with you more about this as the date approaches. And Michael and I decidedly will not be in Paris for the Olympics. We look forward to watching it with you on TV.
Exactly. All right. Good to talk to you guys. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alex.
Bye.
Okay, so the Olympics in Paris look like it's going to be a nearly impossible production. And yet, that was certainly not the case in 1967, when an all-black production of Hello, Dolly! Was a smash sensation on Broadway. John Mautry is here to tell us all about that moment. John is a conductor and a writer. He's currently working on a book called Broadway Black and White, Assimilation and Activism in the Broadway Musical, along with his colleague John McWhorter and with the musicologist Michael Gildon. Welcome, John.
Well, my pleasure to see you, hear you all again.
John, your story about the all-black production of Hello, Dolly! Is so wonderful, and it unfolds to me and to Michael, too. It should be a television show or a film or something. It is so cinematic, and of course, it's all about Broadway, so that makes sense. But tell us about the Broadway star Pearl Bailey and how, in the 1960s, she was the force behind the creation of this incredible production.
What's so interesting is that she needed a career boost because she had been on Broadway but had never been in a real hit. So she was surviving really well. I mean, mind you, she released 20 LPs. overseas, and she was always a guest on television shows, but she was a guest on somebody else's television shows. So David Merrick had also a similar problem. He had Hello, Dolly, which had opened in 1964. Now it was 1967, right? And so how do you keep a show running? Well, you keep changing dollies. And not only did he have Dolly with the original Dolly, Carol Channing, but there was a first national tour. There was a second national tour. It was going everywhere. So they met by chance. This is the most wonderful thing. They were both going to be on a show called What's My Line, which was a quiz show that had been running since 1950. It was canceled already. So they were in the last dregs of that time. And I don't know whether Merrick had been thinking about this or not, but he looked at her and he said, I've got an idea for you. And she said something like, I'm all ears. And the idea was to cast Dolly with her as Dolly. Now, Hello, Dolly, all white cast in the whole history of not only Hello, Dolly, but the play it's based on and the play it's based on. So the idea of doing this is so brilliant. So they signed a contract and they kept it a secret for something like 8 or 9 months. And you can imagine how hard that is. You've got Ginger Rogers is playing it on Broadway. You've got Mary Martin. You've got people all over the country keeping this a secret. So he had to figure out how he was going to cast it. Was it interracial? And he had the idea, this brilliant idea of the entire cast being black. Now, what does that mean? That meant that not a word, not a choreographic gesture, no new songs, no jazzing it up for black people, just performing the exact same show that two nights before was being performed by an all-white cast with an all-black cast. Now, this really was one of those celebratory moments in 1967, because we're in the era just after the Civil Rights Act has passed, the Voting Rights Act has passed, and it became a kind of a party in which white people, black people, anybody in between were invited to celebrate. And I was lucky enough to see Pearl play it, and it was absolutely astonishing. It was a huge, huge hit. And all the arguments, part of the article I wrote was about how the moment it was announced, everyone was arguing, no, no, this is back to the Cotton Club days. No, no, we need an interracial cast. This is setting back civil rights. And what was so great is that Pearl always stood for the truth. And she said, I'm here because of love. And it's just wonderful. And I can tell you, sitting in the audience, she comes out and she loves you, you love her, and everybody gets to celebrate. It's a real moment in Broadway history, the history of black performers and writers and white writers who all the way through the century were working on subliminally changing the attitudes of America towards civil rights.
John, how did the press respond? I mean, we know that this show was a smash among the public, but tell us about some of the reviews that came out.
Well, they were ecstatic. And in fact, the New York Times started with, I was really worried that this was just going to be the worst thing ever. And the moment she came on stage, she took the whole show and wrapped it around like a boa and just took over. Everybody went nuts. I mean, even Jackie Robinson, you ready for this? I mean, the great baseball player, civil rights activist, writes a review and says this show should be taken to the inner cities. People were writing this black injection into the material was so great that maybe every show needs this. It was an amazing moment. In all of the arguments about what's best, what are activists, where do the speeches happen, where nonviolent, violent, all that stuff, this was a moment to celebrate.
John, how long did Hello, Dolly run on Broadway?
It ran until, I think, around 1970 of the original production, mind you. It was in Vietnam and it was everywhere. I mean, I was lucky enough to perform with Carol Channing. She sang Hello, Dolly at the Hollywood Bowl. She was one of the most wonderful, giving, loving people. The significance of this story is that opening night with Pearl Bailey, who was sitting in the front row, Carol Channing. And the next year, there was a television special of the two of them. No one blonder and whiter than Carol Channing, right? With this black icon. And they sang Hello, Dolly together in red sequins. People can find it on YouTube. It's just astonishing to see the love of these two women and the celebration that was Hello, Dolly.
John, what happened to Pearl Bailey after Hello, Dolly? What turns did her career take next?
Well, she became a real star as a result of it. The role of Dolly was a kind of career extender. So people like Dorothy L'Amour, who played it, Mary Martin, Ethel Merman, Ginger Rogers, you go through the list. It took women of a certain age whose careers had kind of like gone into a kind of a limbo and it extended them because it's a love fest. And the way it was staged, you see, with that passerelle, where in the song Hello Dolly, she actually comes down and is looking at the front row of the audience, was a kind of a love fest. I mean, it just happened with Bette Midler just a few seasons ago. Same thing, a miraculous piece of writing. And Jerry Herman, of course, score was just brilliant.
John, one of the things I found very poignant and powerful in your story is when President Johnson then came backstage to see her as well.
Well, this was also an extraordinary thing. Before it opened on Broadway, it tried out in Washington. So it's running on Broadway, it's on tour, and this whole new set, all the costumes are built, and they're trying it out in Washington. And Pearl, who was an extraordinary person, I regret never having performed with her. She wrote to the White House. She wrote to President Johnson. And she had this idea of how to solve the world's problems. And when Johnson read the letter, he and Lady Bird came to a matinee. And they came for Act Two, didn't see Act One. And he went crazy. I mean, it was a moment where he was tapping his foot and he came up on stage. It's a great picture, which is in the article, on stage with Lady Bird, with Cab Calloway on one side and Pearl Bailey. And he shook hands with every member of the cast. It's a little bit of like what Truman did before Porgy and Bess in the 1950s went on tour to Europe. Again, before it went on tour to Europe, President Truman, it was the middle of August, and of course he was not in Washington, like no one should ever be in Washington in August. He flew back, he saw it, he shook hands with everyone, and then the tour of Porgy and Bess went off to Europe. And it again became, here's a moment where black and white artists work together to bring the melting pot, to celebrate the great part about America. Changing hearts and minds through entertainment is a very kind of sneaky way to do it, right? Because it's not a speech. It's not a firebrand speech. It's not signing legislation, though it can lead to signing legislation. When you start to change people's attitudes, and why Broadway? Well, for the first half of the century, last century, the audience was white and they were rich. They controlled the levers of power. So if you put material into a white show in which a black person becomes the best person in that story, you start to change people's minds. And that's the achievement here. That's the most amazing thing. So the Pearl Bailey story is just part of this tremendous history of the last century.
Well, John, it's an incredible story, and the context that you bring to it is really unparalleled. Thank you so much for it.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene: AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Michael, it is the weekend. I know you've got something you can recommend.
Well, I do. I've got two things. One is a new restaurant here in this city that I'm very excited about. Actually, were you living in New York City when Don Angie opened?
Oh, yes. I loved it so much. I only went a few times, but I wish I could go back right now.
Okay, yes. It opened up a few years ago and sort of became fantastically famous for its two chefs, Angela Rito and Scott Tuccinelli. And I'm happy to say they've got a new place just next door in the old space, if you know New York City, where Benny's Burritos used to be over there on Greenwich Ave. It is a place called San Sabino. I went to tasting the other night. It's fantastic. And beginning actually with, you know what I gave up on a long time ago is ordering spaghetti alla vongole anywhere because it always just has no taste. I had it there. They have a version of it and I felt like I was eating it. I felt like it was right back in Positano. It's so salty and briny and good. Delicious. They have this fantastic steak. The pastas are amazing. It's called San Sabino here in New York City. And secondly, have you seen American Fiction yet?
Love, love, love. Jeffrey Wright, king of my heart.
Let's talk about it. What do you love about it?
Well, first of all, it's a bit of a send up of the book industry, which in our universe, we always love. He's just an incredible actor. I mean, he's already played so many really wonderful roles, but I feel like he really shines in this one.
It's terrific. It's just sort of continuing our theme. It's Oscar weekend. And if you haven't caught up on this film with Jeffrey Wright, you're exactly right. One of the true greats of acting, nominated for an Academy Award for this for Best Actor. And as you say, it's a terrific send up of the publishing industry and identity, right?
It made me want to go back and read the book that it was based on, a novel also called, have you read that, Michael? It's called Erasure by Percival Everett. Came out in 2001.
I have not read it, but it came out like 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, you can sort of imagine that it took a while to get made, and I'm sure there were bumps along the road, but man, pretty incredible film.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know the story, Wright plays a frustrated novelist professor who never has been a bestseller, and he decides to write this satire of a stereotypical quote-unquote black book, only for it to become a surprise bestseller, and then he has to sort of maintain the persona that he's taken on. But terrific, and I encourage you all to watch it. It's available now, streaming on Apple Plus TV.
Wonderful.
And you, my dear?
I'm just reading Demon Copperhead and The Bee Sting. So between the two of those, I haven't been reading anything new, but I will say thank you all so much for joining us. We wish you a wonderful weekend. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly, but we will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thank you again for joining us.